This episode is brought to you by the Arvada Center, because they're kicking off their summer concert series in June. Relax under the stars at the Arvada Center's outdoor amphitheater and take in acts like Melissa Etheridge, Big Richard, Tower of Power, Preservation Hall Jazz Band, The Spin Doctors, and so much more. Concerts are scheduled for June through September. You can find a whole schedule of events and get your tickets today at arvadacenter.org. That's arvadacenter.org. Today on CityCast Denver. Between the Gaza protests still growing at Auraria campus and state lawmakers scrambling in the final stretch of the legislative session, tensions in Denver are high and rising. So on our Friday news roundup this week, we're talking about what's next for the protests, the political fights spilling onto social media, the suspicious arrest of a hot dog vendor, and all the other big stories of the week. Today is Friday, May 3rd. I'm Bree Davies, and here's what Denver's talking about. Welcome back to CityCast Denver, the show about the city with three competing celebrations happening this weekend: Cinco de Mayo, the Kentucky Derby, and May the 4th be with you. Justine, what are you looking forward to?
I never the Kentucky Derby, but
really, I didn't want to assume because also you like a good party.
I do like a good party. That is a fact about me. But I think the Derby's just not really my scene.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. I like checking out everyone's outfits and stuff. But if you're going to pick your drunken crowd to be with, that's not exactly my crowd for the weekend.
I feel you. So I'm guessing Cinco then.
Cinco. I love Cinco de Mayo. I love being the Denver historian on Cinco de Mayo every year and getting like deep into why we celebrate.
No, I've been following Westwood, Cultura Chocolate. They're doing some stuff in Westwood around that very thing, is bringing back the historical component so folks know what it's really about.
Yes.
So, Sarah, what about you? Are you celebrating any of these three events?
Maybe Cinco de Mayo.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to wander up the street to Westwood and see what's going on. Well, it's Friday. We're in the 5280 Magazine studios, and we have a couple of great guests today. You've already heard their voices. We always, returning fave, our politics and green chili correspondent, Justine Sandoval, is here. Hi, Justine.
Hello.
And joining us for the first time, she's the editor-in-chief of the Metropolitan, MSU's student-run newspaper. Sarah Martin, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, our top story today is, you were the voice we wanted to hear from, Sarah. We're talking about campus protests on the Tivoli Quad. They've been going on for over a week now with tents still up and a number of protests across state colleges. It's only growing. So, Sarah, can you just give us an update as to where things are right now with communications between the university and the student protesters?
Yeah, I think so far, especially as I think of this morning, the protests are still out there on the Tivoli Quad. The universities are still in contact with the protesters and the community that's out there. They're in dialogue and they want to continue the dialogue. The update I read so far is no police will be called until it's like deemed necessary, is I think the words I
feel so
I read
vague.
This. It is very, it's very vague.
Yeah. What do you make of that sort of statement, Justine?
It's interesting. Didn't feel good seeing all those police images. I think it was from this weekend when, heavily armed officers were going through the protest. I mean, it's reminiscent of protest past. And it's interesting, too, how we have a response like this whenever people set up a tent anywhere.
No matter
if it's a student protest or if it's people trying to survive. Nothing like some tents to get a police response.
Yeah, Denver really does not like tents. So, Sarah, something else we were talking about earlier off mic was that there's three colleges on this campus, which means sort of three different administrations trying to handle this. How is that going communications-wise with the students and the demands?
I think it varies between especially CU Denver and MSU. CU has most of the demands against them from the protesters. MSU is a little bit more murky since they don't have anything really based in Israel from what like donors or any companies that they invest in are based there. And CU has most of that connection there.
And I think the CU thing too, the issue part of it is like Boulder is really where
the administration is. So it's kind of like how they're able to even communicate those things seems a little confusing.
Yeah. The CU system, I'm not super familiar with it, but it's very different than MSU because, you know, you have your chancellors for each campus. So you have a chancellor for Denver and Colorado Springs and Boulder, and then they all report to a president. So it's a very different hierarchy than MSU Denver has because they just have a president and a board of, like, regents.
Sure. So you've been on the ground covering this all week. What are you thinking about as a student as well as a journalist?
Can I comment on that ethically?
I guess that's a good question. Yeah. I mean, whatever you feel comfortable talking about, maybe even more just from the journalism side, then what are you seeing and feeling from your fellow students?
Yeah, I think overall, and also probably what I'm feeling as well, is just very disappointed in the response that happened on last Friday when they brought in Denver police and campus police and just, you know, tore through these protesters and dragged them off a lawn. I saw a lot of people get hurt, people punched and dragged on the concrete and blood, and it was just very shocking to see, especially on that campus. That campus has a land acknowledgement. You know, we have diversity, equity, inclusion. You know, they stand for all these things and they constantly repeat that. But then they bring in police against a community that is largely marginalized. MSU Denver has the seal of excellencia, which means we're a Hispanic serving institution. And a lot of our students are also undocumented. And, you know, there's a lot of repercussions if undocumented folks are arrested.
Put into this legal system bind. Justine, what do you think about that? I mean, you're someone who's been involved with activism here in Denver for a long time. You know, you're joking about being the Denver historian. You're deep in the history of this. You also went to college. We both went to college there. What do you think about that particular issue, this response that the students are seeing that seems pretty rough?
You know, it's disappointing to see every generation at these universities make the same mistake in response. You know, I grew up as a student activist, starting at North High School, continued on to Auraria. The fight of my generation was definitely against the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. So, and then prior to that, too, my grandmother was in the Chicano Rights Movement, which was a student-led movement that happened at West High School and on Auraria campus. And even before that, my family's history goes back to living in that community in the Auraria neighborhood. So, yeah, there is this, you know, this spirit of activism, student activists, especially by marginalized students there. And they've been on the right side of history. And we've seen these protests later on and seen their significance. And always look back at these administrations' reaction as the wrong response, yet they continue to do the same thing for another generation. So,
yeah, what do you think? I like this point you brought up, Sarah, about these. I don't want to say they're performative, but can feel performative if we have land acknowledgments and DEI stuff. But then, like exactly what you're saying is, but then when things new issues are brought up, the response seems to be the same. What do you think about that?
You know, I think right now, these universities' responses, like I was listening to a lot of the stuff that's been going on at Columbia University, which was the university that kind of sparked a lot of this stuff across the nation.
Right.
So Rare is one piece of this large movement of students throughout the country. You know, there are a lot of university presidents that are trying to appease like these Republican committees, education committees, who are trying to get them in these very compromising conversations and situations. So they're trying to walk the line when I think what they really need to be doing as academic institutions is sitting down with their students and creating environments for constructive conversation. A lot of the demands from students, you know, some of it's beyond like the scope of what these university presidents can do, but it's a piece for them to start talking with students and say, okay, this is what we can do, this, and actually have a dialogue and actually start setting up these processes on campus to work with students to come up with solutions.
Do you see any of that happening, Sarah? I mean, we've seen politicians show up. Are we seeing administrators meet students where they are?
I think now in the today and coming days, I think there has been more dialogue. Previously to what happened on Friday, there was, I believe, no dialogue on Friday except somebody coming out. I think it was our police chief, Jason Melender, came out. And
the Auraria campus chief police. Okay.
He came out with like a bullhorn and was like, you have, you know, 15 minutes to disperse. And that was the end of all discussions pretty much of like, please get off the lawn and otherwise you're going to get arrested.
Doesn't feel like a conversation.
That's interesting because I remember the area police actually worked with us a lot when we were student protesting. Really? And it wasn't just a like clear out notice. There was always a lot of conversation and a lot of effort to protect students' free speech is what I experienced. So that's disappointing to hear that there's just this response to clear students out.
I'm seeing something that's like, you know, after the 2020 George Floyd protests, there was all this push towards accountability and conversations with police and these changes in how the structures are working. I'm thinking about what was going on in Aurora with the Aurora Police Department, but it's almost like it's like snapping back the other direction even harder. Do you I don't know. Maybe I'm making too much of that, but I just see a response being stronger than I would expect against these student protesters that by all means have been peaceful.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Well, there's this other element too, which is a lot of legislators are showing up, a lot of sort of very prominent activist voices. I wonder, Justine, you know, we know a lot of these folks from other activist circles. What do you think of non-students showing up to this student-led? How do those things work together?
You know, after going through the George Floyd protest in Denver, and, you know, that was a very kind of traumatic experience because we had a lot of infiltrators that caused a lot of harm in that movement. So personally, I do feel weary sometimes of too many outsiders, and I want to focus on centering student voices. And in that space, that is the most powerful voice to be heard. So I think that we should be wary of too many outsiders influencing what the students are doing on campus. And even though people want to be there and support, I think you know, they should think of ways to support, in other ways to support these encampments instead of being there because it's not always helpful to the students on campus who are trying to lead this effort.
Sarah, have you heard anything from students about that? Because I'm assuming it feels great when you have folks supporting you, but there's some folks that are like in the spotlight now that aren't students.
Yeah, that's like, I don't want to say it's a myth, but that's something I think we're trying to dispel in our reporting. We've been out there every day since last Wednesday, I believe it was, just keeping our like eyes and ears out because of what was happening in Columbia. And a vast majority of people we talk to are connected to campus in some way. They are students, alums, their parents, their professors, they're even just like professional staff that work within the tri-institutions. And yes, there are definitely some people out there that aren't connected, and I've talked with them, but they are also friends of students, and they're also, I think we've had some students from like Denver University, and I believe Colorado Springs. So
maybe it's more of a media conversation, is like who we tend to be spotlighting versus what's actually happening in the moment with the folks that are organizing. That's a good way to sort of distinguish it. So Justine, there's a couple of things about this protest that I want to ask you about. I've heard there's students attending class remotely, like from the tents, and we saw a projector set up to watch the Nuggets game. I mean, this is so different than our experience. What do you think about this sort of new way of protesting while also being active in the rest of your life?
I mean, I like it because this is, you know, where we are now as a society to have that, you know, ability to remotely work outside of the classroom. I was notorious for missing class. Sorry, Dr. Denning, politics and elections class, which I often miss to protest and work on the Obama campaign. So there was not really that opportunity to do both. But I think that, you know, students are trying to be out there and fight and say that we're really tired of money going towards these types of conflicts. Meanwhile, they're strapped to student debt. You know, there's unrest. So I think that being able to do both, to fight for the world you want to see, is also a learning lesson as well as being in the classroom. I have heard some reports that they were cutting off power to students and some other issues trying to make it harder for them to work from the area. So I don't know if that's true, but that was some reports I heard too, which I thought was very counterproductive to a university. Yeah.
I heard that too. Sarah, did you see that happening? Or
I believe that, and they're also cutting off access to facilities, so they can't go inside and use like bathrooms. And
oh.
Yeah, there's been some issues with that. I don't know if you saw they brought in porta potties.
Yeah, I saw someone say like, okay, you complained, so we brought in porta potties, but now they're mad that the administration is mad that there's porta potties at the camp.
Yeah, they're calling it like a sanitation and like health and safety issue. And so they're like, okay, well, if you're having an issue with this, they contracted like a portable toilet company and brought in these porta potties that are
the problem.
Yeah, that are going to be serviced. And I believe it was yesterday they even said that, oh, we're going to call the police on you because you have these porta potties out here.
That's so weird because it's a semi-public institution, right? So these students are paying student fees and those all go to – they have a AHEC fee to facility. So to deny them bathroom use is like a violation of student rights, I would think.
Like, you heard it here first if anybody's not already working on that. Yeah. That's a good point though, Justine. But I guess that's maybe what I want to get to here, Sarah, with the administration is they say they're supporting the students' right to protest, but as long as it doesn't like disrupt – the regular day-to-day campus life, which kind of conflicts with what the right to protest is about. You've talked about this earlier off mic. It's final season. You all are so busy. Have the protests been disruptive?
I mean, in my personal opinion, no, they haven't been disruptive. They're literally just sitting out on a lawn and reading some books and chanting every now and again, but they're not, you know, going after people who are just walking past, and they're not agitative. They've been receptive even to like local media and student journalists kind of walking into the camp. So yeah. I wouldn't say they've been disruptive.
Sarah, have you heard anything? I know the Kentucky Derby Days event is supposed to happen on the quad this weekend. I could see protests and this ticketed event maybe not going together so well. Have you heard anything about that?
I haven't heard anything about that yet. I know last Friday when they arrested people, they were going to have a 5K run on the Tivoli Quad.
Oh, that's right.
So I believe that might have been their predisposition to clear the protesters. So I don't know what's going to happen.
I guess it's kind of we'll wait and see. So Justine, you mentioned this a little bit, but your history with this camp, you and I both went to school there. How do you see just the campus's role in Denver's sort of protest history or our history and activism?
It's a very important location for many movements that have went on in this city. And, you know, it continues to be that spot, a gathering spot. It's a commuter campus that has about 38,000 students that it serves on a daily basis. That's either in person or online. But it's a big community, and you're serving three different institutions. So its voice is big in the city, its impact and things coming from this campus do mean something, especially in Denver.
Yeah, that's a great point. Sarah, before we wrap up here, what are you watching as these protests continue? I mean, things have changed every day. Is there anything you're watching for?
Yeah, I think specifically we're looking at, you know, watching Columbia and UCLA and seeing what protesters are doing there and seeing how if tactics aren't working here on the Rary campus, what next steps are these protesters going to take? Are they going to occupy the Tivoli building tomorrow?
Right, because this has just happened to Columbia. Good point.
So that's something we've been looking out at, and just kind of some other tactics maybe the administration might take with police action, depending on what's going on campus, because we're coming into a big season of events. You know, Cinco de Mayo, you have the Avs and the Nuggets in the playoffs,
right,
which Ball Arena sits right across from the Rary campus, and they do a lot of like watch parties. And so there's a lot of playoff stuff coming up too. So yeah, if they really want to capitalize on using that space on the quad, I do know they want those protesters gone.
Well, we'll be watching the story as it continues to develop. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, social media at the Capitol. A few hours after we recorded this conversation, Sarah reported that Auraria campus leaders offered a $15,000 donation to the Red Cross in Gaza if the encampment was removed by 5 p.m. Thursday. The students reportedly rejected the offer, and negotiations are set to continue. This episode is brought to you by Pine Melon, the farmer's market delivered. Pine Melon is a next-generation grocery delivery app that partners with over 200 farmers, ranchers, and producers in Colorado to help make fresh, locally sourced foods available to the Denver community at fair prices.
Get high-quality meats, eggs, and dairy from small local farms, fresh-baked breads from local bakeries, and more, as well as all of your favorite pantry staples. Best part is, Pine Melon offers same-day delivery to Denver and soon Boulder within a two-hour window, no subscription necessary. Save time in your busy schedule and get fresh and healthy groceries delivered right to your door. Join the movement and support local today. Use promo code CityCastDenver for $75 off your first delivery at pinemelon.com. That's pinemelon.com.
And we're back. We're talking about social media at the Capitol this session. Marianne Goodland put out an article in Colorado Politics this week that brings up some of this social media attention that was happening this session. And then specifically, State House reporter Jesse Paul from the Colorado Sun tweeted, "More so than previous sessions, social media has been a real source of friction this year at the Colorado Capitol, with lawmakers attacking each other, journalists, etc." Justine, you're someone who's been on Twitter for a long time. I think we may have officially like sort of met there many, many years ago, but you also work in politics. What did you think about Jesse's comment?
It's very true. I've seen before in the past, social media, especially Twitter, became a big tool with hashtag co-politics. And it was more about the legislators doing their thing and not so much being the actual tweeters. And then these outside people are like, doing the warring, and now it's like directly them fighting on Twitter. It's interesting because I was thinking about it, and there's a lot of people who got a lot of recognition from being online and social media before and kind of operate from that area are now, you know, in the state legislature, and they're still
operating that
from
way.
There instead of being like changing the focus into the building. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I want to get into that because I do have a question about the parallel nature of what happens online versus what happens in reality. But Sarah, you're a younger journalist who I would assume you use Twitter because you have to, not because you want to. What is your view of sort of that aspect when it comes to things like politics?
I think there's kind of this generational divide on, especially my generation, Gen Z. We are being currently taught in school, you know, please watch what you're putting on your social media and what you say and what you put out there, because there is like this traceable trail that will come back to find you. But I think a lot of these boomers and Gen X don't really understand that. And like what's out there will find you and will follow you for a really long time.
Lives forever. I feel like this was an early threat, though, Justine, especially with Facebook. It was like, watch what you post on Facebook. Your employers might see it. But it's also now like I still see people posting things that I can't believe they're posting, and they're like a public official. It doesn't seem to have mattered.
Yeah.
Maybe this is the generational issue.
I think it's okay to have a social media presence still. Like it's like it was like lock down your Facebook because your employer is going to look at it. I think it's okay now more and like encouraged to have your personality or your like page out there. But I think really after the Trump era, honestly, a lot of that like decency and like maybe level of decorum just kind of went out the window, and people like the respect level has went down, and people are just willing to say more awful things.
I mean, we've seen some pretty awful things. But I'm also thinking, Justine, there's many lawmakers who aren't tweeting, or maybe they don't run their own accounts, which is pretty common. So it's like these parallel conversations happening, one online and then one like in real life. How do you think that plays out for legislators? Like, do you have to relay a Twitter fight to a legislator who might not be online or as extremely online as other politicians? How does this work?
I don't know how they do this, honestly, because I would go insane from, you know, like I've been in my share of like online spats, and it gets to a point where you're like, oh, when I see you, I better not see you around town. And then these people are doing that, and then they go to work the next day, or they
like literally sitting have to
next
see
each other, and to be able to just go about your day and not actually like go to blows is pretty amazing half the time. But you're seeing that go into the chamber because I've heard reports of, you know, people basically continuing to troll each other on the House floor offline,
continuing that online conversation in real life. It's such a strange thing. Sarah, how do you view social media you're a young person who's a journalist who's going to be using it whether you like it or not? But I guess how do you view it? Is it a tool for you? Is it just a thing, a necessity?
I feel like being a journalist and having to use social media has just definitely changed my perspective and enjoyment on it. It's more of a, you know, a dread on the day to, you know, open Twitter and open Instagram and things like that. I mean, even I just experienced this last week. We had Elizabeth Epps and Tim Hernandez on our campus, and I tweeted out, you know, some quotes and some videos of them speaking, and then all, you know, all those people were just in my comments saying probably the most volatile things I've ever seen in my comments on Twitter. And I'm like, wow, I'm really thankful I'm not a legislative reporter, because I don't think I could deal with this every day in my comments.
Do you think that Gen Z is approaching it differently? Because I'm thinking about someone, we've had Tim on the show many times. He's definitely a Gen Z legislator. Me and our producer, Olivia, were talking about this. He doesn't even use social media in the same way that I think some Gen Xers and millennials even do. What do you think that the Gen Z approach is to using it, like maybe as a legislator even?
Honestly, I've seen a lot of my friends and colleagues just take a step back from social media. I've seen a lot of people saying, oh, I'm doing a cleanse. They delete the apps off their phones. Yeah. And I feel like we're a little less present and less willing to share personal things on social media than, say, some boomers or like my parents and people like that.
So I'm also thinking about, there was this story of two Democratic lawmakers who resigned last year, citing this toxic environment in the House. Do either of you think this is also the online environment issue?
Oh, yeah, it's simply part of it. X, formerly Twitter, has become super toxic with like bot attacks. It's funny you mentioned that tweet, because anything that I've retweeted or commented on the state legislature in the last few months instantly is like 70 hate messages back that come out. Like, I have to instantly shut down because it's out of control. So even the online environment has, you know, heated up. So I think, yeah, that's a piece of it. Definitely a piece of the toxicity.
Yeah. So the other thing I struggle with is like, how is anyone getting anything done? Like, if you spend all day online, I've been that very online person. It's very difficult to actually get work done. Do you all think that this is impacting the way that lawmakers are functioning, like at their jobs?
I think it's really counterproductive. I follow the legislature, you know, as a student journalist, but I'm not in there completely. And I see all these legislatures like fighting online in each other's like comments. And I'm like, what are you doing at work? Like, what are you actually, what are you getting done for the people? Like, you're there to represent all these groups of people, and you're sitting there on your phone sending out mean tweets. Like, what are you doing?
How do you think that affects productivity, Justine? I mean, you're in both of these spaces. You see both sides of this.
So. Yeah, it's not great. When you're in there, the job is to pass laws. And I think that, you know, it's disappointing because some of the disrespect going on from certain legislators to others is nothing new.
Right.
There's like, you know, people of color have been fighting to get into these spaces for a long time and have to follow these rules of decorum and, you know, get disrespected by people who don't want them there. And we've said that that's not acceptable, but yet now we've entered an era where harassing our colleagues online, you know, taking pictures of them on the House floor, doing these really like nasty things have become okay. And there really has to be a higher standard we set to our elected officials in there, that they're going to follow the golden rule.
I was just thinking
others
that
how you want to be
just
treated.
Just like mutual respect idea. Just something very simple.
Like, I can hate everything you stand for on policy and what you support, but part of the job is having to sit in that room with this person and respect them and have a dialogue to make the best decision for society. So it is counterproductive to what the goal is of the building.
Do you guys think that there's power in social media clout when it comes to politics?
I mean, we can look at like a Lauren Boebert or a Marjorie Taylor Greene, or even like, I know one of the people who's been accused of lots of harassment was Rep. Brandi Bradley.
Yes, who also she came up a lot in this story.
Yeah, and she comes from that world of like, you know, mega tweeters, anti-vax, anti-trans moms, parental rights moms, who really like found this whole social media platform, who end up in these spaces.
So it can work to a certain extent that maybe like attracting voters or support, but I just wonder, I don't know. Sarah, how do you see this as someone sort of like, if definitely a younger generation watching this?
I would say I think it's an echo chamber, especially come to legislatures and, you know, you're not reaching my grandmother on Twitter. Like, you know, you're reaching a very specific group of people and probably not the people who vote for you.
And we forget participation in voting is low. We always say half the country votes, but half the country doesn't vote. Like a quarter of the country votes, and then that quarter is split in half.
I'm so, yeah. I'm curious to see with this election, especially with what's going on right now with the protests, how that's going to unfold for younger voters for sure. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, our Rocky Mountain highs and lows of the week. And we're back. We're looking at things that ruled, things that sucked this week. As usual, we'll start with our fails, the things that sucked, so we can end on a good note. Justine, what's your fail for the week?
So my fail for the week, I can't help but smile because the Jefferson County Republicans are always doing something. But the Jeffco County Republicans are bringing admitted dog killer Christy Noem to their fundraiser this Saturday in Golden. And I seriously Googled dog killer, like just dog killer, and only Christy Noem stories.
Tell me
up.
This story. I don't know this story.
So Governor of North Dakota, Christy Noem. I had to Google again. I just dog killer and Christy Noem came up. Wrote this book, North Dakota. of South Dakota. And she wrote in this memoir about this puppy she had that was untrainable and, quote, more than useless, and how she shot the dog because she couldn't train it. Lots of reaction across both aisles on this admission.
We all know this is always an owner problem.
Totally.
And not a dog problem. But so they're bringing her out?
Yeah. So they had already scheduled to bring her out for this fundraiser prior to this these comments coming out from this book. But it's just kind of mind-blowing to me in Colorado. Like, this country loves dogs, but Colorado really loves dogs. I mean, there's more dogs than children in Colorado. We've had a dog mayor. Like, this is the dog state.
I mean, you're a person that would take your dog camping, and you didn't have a camping dog.
No, I took my dog on vacation.
You had a princess dog.
Yeah. I remember I took her on a trip, and the lady at the hotel was like, you brought your dog on a trip? I'm like, yeah, she likes to stay in hotels, okay? So this is not the state.
This is a Colorado thing.
So it's questionable to me that they would still go forward with this, but it's not surprising. knowing who's in charge of the Colorado GOP right now. But I would say that the fail of the week is the Jefferson County Republicans still going forward with their fundraiser this weekend with Christy.
Featuring Christy dog killer Noem. Okay, Sarah, what have you got?
Mine's rather unfortunate. I went out to a dinner the other day out in Rhino, parked my car, went to this dinner. And then I come back and someone sideswiped my car.
Oh.
And I'm about to sell it next week.
Oh. No! Which street?
Oh, gosh. It's the one with, like, Uchi on it.
Yeah, Walnut or Blake. One of them. Awful.
Is it just because there's just, like, the parking is so tight kind of thing?
Yeah, and I think...
I mean, people just drive terrible. Also, let's be realistic. Yes, let's be realistic.
I think the person just, like, ran off because I couldn't, like, find the, like, same paint color. But I believe they're just, like, trying to parallel park, but...
I'm sorry. That is such an annoying bummer. Well, mine is... Katie Cheshire Westward reported that a hot dog vendor was arrested outside Ball Arena after Game 5 when the Nuggets crushed the Lakers. The DPD arrested the man for illegally selling hot dogs, not having a peddler license, and not following protocols for mobile vending outside the arena. I guess if you're going to be selling things, you have to have a permit, and you also have to be able to carry that wherever you go. However, like, arresting him? Like, do we need to arrest a guy selling hot dogs? Maybe just, I don't even know if you need to ticket him. Just tell him to go away. I don't know. Felt like overkill. Also, we were celebrating. Like, let people have a hot dog.
Yeah, that whole story.
It was so annoying. I was just like, why is this happening?
But it was funny because the person who recorded it and posted online was like, they're doing a hot dog sting. And then Denver police had to come out and say, there was no planned hot dog sting.
Because they were like, the officers were in plain clothes. And then it was like a guy in a Nugget shirt, but he also had his badge on. And he's like, but I'm still a cop. Like, we weren't we weren't planted here, but we saw him doing something illegal. And I was like, even more loser behavior. Like, I was just enjoying the game, but I had to stop to arrest a hot dog vendor. Like,
well, I went deep into like what the requirements were. And it's actually not, it's like $25 fee and a $50 licensing fee. So it's not very much. But the whole like peddler thing is weird. So like the hot dog cart is movable.
Yeah.
But it has to be like on your per, like,
I
you
think
can't
you have to, it has to, you have to be
anywhere.
Like the beer man where you can carry it around, I guess. Like in
and
the
they're worried
stadium?
About like food safety. But I'm sorry, I'm kind of a weirdo about food safety, like at home, but I will eat those hot dogs from anywhere.
I know, I'm with you. Like, I will eat a hot
but
dog.
But yeah, if I'm out in public and they're like, and it was the good Mexican hot dogs
with
the
bacon around them.
Yeah,
see,
that.
I think they could have just went and caught the person who hit my car instead of finding the person who's selling hot dogs illegally.
This was also an argument I saw online. Someone was like, why aren't they policing people like that are stealing? Why aren't we dealing with real crime instead of arresting a guy selling hot dogs?
Things that piss me off, bad drivers in Rhino. Things that make me happy. Mexican hot dog guy.
That's it. Well, let's move on to our wins this week, things that we're happy to celebrate or excited about. Justine, what have you got?
My win, I mentioned already earlier, Cinco de Mayo weekend in Denver. But the actual win is that Cinco de Mayo is on a Sunday this year.
Hell yeah.
Which if you were here in the 90s, that is the most sacred day to have Cinco de Mayo on because that was cruising day.
It's like joining two beautiful things together.
Exactly. Cinco Sunday. It's like happens only every so many years. So very excited for that. And, you know, I long for the Cinco of the 90s sometimes. And I really want to encourage people once again to reflect on what this means. And I know everyone's going to be like, they don't even celebrate this in Mexico. No, they don't, because this is an American holiday that was adopted by the Chicano rights movement to have something for us to celebrate and share our culture with the city of Denver. So I'm excited. Civic Center will be doing all the fun stuff down there. You know, like diversify. Don't spend your Cinco de Mayo in Rhino or the Highlands or Cinco de Drinco
Bar. Federales or whatever weird
go
bar.
Down to Civic Center. Get some culture.
See some folklorico
watch
dancers.
Your little primos and primas dance, you know, on the stage there. And then go down and support a local business that serves like some really good Mexican
real tacos
food.
Or,
go find you a dive bar with an old Chicano guy named Lino.
Yes.
He's going to sell you a dusty beer. Like, go and really celebrate the culture. So that is my encouragement. That's my win for the week. Weekend.
That's awesome. I love it. Cinco on a Sunday. Sarah, what about you?
Yeah, I think my win, and maybe not even just my win, it's my team at the Metropolitan. We just won 2 SPJ awards for the market excellence. So yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
For stellar reporting. That's so cool and so crucial. I want to thank you and your colleagues for doing the work you're doing down there, because it's just so much easier to hear from folks that are actually present on the campus every day to understand the context of what's happening there. But congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I believe student journalists are doing such great work around the country right now. And it's really just amazing to see.
That's incredible. Well, mine's just one of those hits the nostalgia spots. Denverite is so good at it. Rebecca Tauber did this piece on defunct restaurants and they shared all these matchbooks. And I was like, nostalgia is so easy for me to fall right into. But I just looked at that matchbook for Racine's and just started dreaming about my favorite. I know, just a tear.
I know.
But also it was just fun to look back. It's always nice to look back at those things and think about the things that we don't have, but like the good memories. And it was just a fun little story. I love little feature stories like that, that are just like, remember when Denver was this dusty ass tiny place?
Oh, I do.
It was super fun. It was super fun. Well, before we go, Sarah, what's the best way for folks to listening to this to follow your work?
Yeah, you can find me on X, formerly known as Twitter, and you can also find me on Instagram as well. So, but most of my journalism work will be on Twitter.
Okay, and what's your handle?
It's at Sarah K. Martin.
Awesome. And Justine, is there any? You're working on so many things. Anything you want to plug?
Oh, so this weekend is the Cobalt Gala. Cobalt is an organization that supports reproductive rights here in Colorado. I think the gala sold out, but I encourage people to donate money to the abortion fund, especially as we get news out of Florida and these other states. Banning abortion in Colorado is even more important than ever before to have access to abortion care. So donate to your local abortion fund.
Awesome. Well, Sarah, Justine, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for today here on CityCast Denver. Our producers this week were Paul Caroli, Elizabeth Kama, Natalie Rivera, A.K. Almumen, Lizzie Goldsmith, and Olivia Jewel Love. Peyton Garcia writes our morning newsletter, Hey Denver. I'm Bree Davies, your host. Our music is by Los Mocachetes with additional mixing by Tyler Lindgren. If you haven't already, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, follow us on Instagram at CityCast Denver, and tell hot dog vendor Alejandro Ramirez about us next time you see him. You can sign up for our daily newsletter and learn more about us at denver.citycast.fm. See you next week. You're millennial.
You X me.
I know. I'm on the cusp. I'm the Gen Xer, and so I think that's kind of what we're going to get into.